This is Bob.
In short, I started business with Bill because I was interested in audio, and I had messed around with high school. I mean messed around. And as some of this is in the book, so if I repeat something, holler at me. But I went to a meeting of the Chicago Audio and Acoustical Group, which no longer exists, and it was at Universal Recording, 111 East Ontario. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I asked Bill afterwards, introduced myself, and I said, I'd like to work for you. And I thought, well, he's going to say, come next Tuesday morning. And he said, well, come around some evening. I thought, evening? Well, it turns out that all the dates he did, which were rhythm and blues at that time, rhythm and blues and pop, was all in the evening. And through the years, I worked for him four separate occasions, and we had arguments here and there, but I found him a fascinating man to work for. He was a mixer, first of all, and he related to the musicians, he related to the artist, he related to the producer. And he didn't treat any of them as idiots. He said, okay, this is what's going on. And he, on occasion, I can remember him saying, particularly on R&B sessions, why don't you do thus and such a rhythm instead of this? And because he understood what was going on. And he was also a design engineer. Most of the stuff that came out of Universal Audio in the early days, other than the LA-2, which came from Jim Lawrence and Teletronics, was done by Bill, and he was also a business manager and a very neat individual. He hired Tony Perry in Chicago, and Tony was the financial side, and between the two of them, they made a great pair because Bill knew he was not a financial genius, but he was a very interesting guy to work for, if we came to him with an idea, it wasn't a case of, well, I don't know if it's going to work, but no, try it. But he was always receptive to ideas. And if you talk to him about some part of thing that is what we have to do, okay, he would do it. And because he related to what was going on. And my first standing inside an echo chamber was at 111 East Ontario, where one night Bill said, come on. We're going upstairs, and we went up past the tape library, through a door, and echo chamber, which was, if I remember it correctly, was probably 10 by 10 by 8, something like that, hard plaster, and silica gel in a bag dripping into a pan, and it was a true chamber, and do this, and wow. And that was my first introduction to a echo chamber. Or reverb chamber, pick your term. There's never been any real clear thing on whether it's an echo chamber or a reverb chamber, other than layers. But it was, and he continued that in Los Angeles. And we made excellent use of chambers. And we had United later on bought Western Recorders a block away, and there were more chambers in that building. So we leased tie lines from Ma Bell Pacific Telephone between the two buildings. And they were 15 KC lines and equalized. And I recall one time that the guys, that was one of the projects. Bill said, hey, we got to tie the buildings together. So I worked with Pacific Telephone. And I remember some of the guys saying, the tie lines are noisy. No. They were a block apart. So I called Pacific Telephone, and they came out with a very handy, fancy transmission test set. And it turns out what they called 0 dB RN, residual noise, was a minus 90 dB, which is kind of minus 90 dBm, kind of quiet. And it turns out that the guys were not really paying attention to how much they were driving the chambers. So when they brought it up to an adequate level, then we had no problems. So we had these, and it was a matter of and the patching was done in Studio 3, wasn't it?
Which end?
Well, at the United end.
At the United end, it was in the dub-down room.
Dub-down room. That was Studio 3.
Well, it wasn't called 3.
At United. Okay, that's right, the dub-down room. And it was also a dub-down room, and the patching was in there. So somebody would arrange for to use one of the reverb chambers at Western or United, depending on what was going on. But as I said, when Bill said to me, we need tie lines, he didn't say, well, da, da, da. He just said, take care of it. And when you got through, you went back to him and said, Bill, okay, this is what's done. This is what's wrong. And, oh, okay, fine. And it was great from that point because he did not micromanage. I don't think he ever did.
No.
And it was just a case of take care of the project. Later on, he wanted to get a... Wow.
241.
And the... Holy Toledo, yes. And later on, he needed a film machine. And I went chasing around, and we could either buy one from Stansel Hoffman, who was a film equipment manufacturer in Hollywood, or we could buy one from Magnatech, who was a manufacturer in New York. And Magnatech was something like 3 weeks out, and Stansel Hoffman said they could deliver in a week and a half. And Bill said, go with that one. Okay, we did. And unfortunately, that piece of equipment, which we very casually referred to as a Standstill Hoffman, it was less than ideal because they had not done their engineering very well, and we had lots of wow. And but Bill never looked at me and said, you know, why'd you make that? Because he knew he had made the instantaneous decision to, okay, let's go with a faster delivery. And he ended me, somebody looks at that and says, tell us that. Well, originally that was a Western Electric 241 patch cord and ridges down one side because that was the negative side. And so when you patched it in, you said, okay, that's the low side. And that was handy, as we talked about last night, because if you patched and it was out of polarity, you turned it over. And nowadays, with the quarter-inch TRS or the mini TRS or TT, as they're called, you can't do that. But and these were also easy to clean. And nowadays, glad you have one here.
Oh, I just appreciate the old times, and I actually worked in a radio station a long time ago that used those.
Yes, right.
So this is a three-conductor patch cord.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, two tips and the ring or sleeve actually, pardon me, and like that, yes.
And this was before TRS was invented?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, before, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I think Ma Bell invented the TRS connection.
Yeah, it's Western Electric.
Then. Western Electric. And they had used it on switchboards. And what's interesting, that on switchboard, the tip was the high side, mm-hmm. because the operator would touch the tip to the sleeve of the jack, and if they got a click in their headphones, that meant that that circuit was in use, busy. But in the audio, it was the other way around, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
But you're not sure either. But it started with with Western Electric, and that was one other thing. If we start looking back, you're going to find out that Western Electric had an awful lot to do with audio. I worked for Westrex in Los Angeles later on, and Frank Pontius, my boss, was fond of talking about loud-speaking telephone. And I thought, okay. And he showed me a data sheet from Western Electric, and it was indeed, they called it a loud-speaking telephone, which is what it was. And I think that's where the term loudspeaker came from. But that's getting off of Bill.
So they called a loudspeaker a loudspeaking telephone.
That's the loudspeaking telephone was the original the term.
Or
yes.
A loudspeaker.
Yeah,
on the
patent. Right,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
111, how many have you know of a 111C repeat coil? Good. That was a big honking transformer. Repeat coil, 600 primary and secondary, was about so big and about so tall. And if somebody has got one for sale and you need a transformer, buy it, unless it costs you $1 million, but like that. No questions yet?
How did Bill start in the recording business?
Shrouded in mystery. It actually, from what we know, he and his partner, Bernie Clapper, got into it by recording East Coast broadcast for delayed broadcast on the West Coast. Transcriptions. 16-inch, they were 16-inch discs, and the cutting lathes, which were would handle that. So they would record those offline from New York, and then they would be held and then played back by the network. I think usually ABC, wasn't it?
Yeah. An hour later,
and
yeah.
They would play it back an hour later or 2 hours later for West Coast. And that's where he got started. And I think he kind of, I have a hunch, he kind of backed into the recording business from there.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And we brought along, where did we put it? There it is. If I may. This isn't the most well-known one, but I won't pass it around because we don't want to drop it. But this was Universal Recording Corp., and it's Jerry Murad and the Harmonicats, and Peg of My Heart was the most well-known recording he did. And his echo chamber, he was in the Civic Opera Building, 20 North Macker, and he used the men's room as an echo chamber. And this, by the way, if anybody doesn't know, was a 78, a trill 78, which you, if you drop it, it will break. That's a start. Anything else? Should I pick up on something more? Do you think it's something else where I should start?
Not off the top of my head, no. Start at the beginning.
At the beginning, yes. But as I said, mono. And not from Bill, but from one of his partners, I learned the art of disc mastering, mono. And the basic thing is very simple, but what you can do with it is something else. And I was working for Atlantic Records in New York, Tom Dowd, and I remember he got a hold of a test pressing that was done by Audio Fidelity of the first stereo record. And that was in early 58. And they had persuaded Westrex to cut them a test lacquer, which they went ahead and processed. And I remember looking at that under one of our Scully lathe microscope and thinking, my God, what is this going to open? Because it was fairly quiet as far as an LP is concerned. But I looked at that in terms of the groove perambulations. Has anybody had a chance to look at a LP under a microscope? Good, okay. And you know, there's a lot going on. And through the years, Jerry and I did our share of disc mastering, particularly stereo. And it is an art. It's a science on the basics of it. And you start out with a 1 mil cut. And we always called it depth of cut. But it was never that. We were measuring the width. But since it was 45, the groove was 90 degrees, the actual width that we were measuring, we always call the depth of cut, but standard. And you say, well, what'd you do? Well, depth of cut, I said it 1 mil, okay.
Yeah, it was close.
Pardon?
It was close.
It was close, yes. Yeah. 1 mil being one thousandth of an inch.
The actual stylus was what, 67 degrees included angle?
Pardon?
The actual stylus was, 67 and a half degrees?
The mono.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And then they went to 90 because they had to because of the 45, the way it works. But
for stereo?
Pardon?
For stereo, went to 90?
Yeah. Had to because this Westrex's system. And I have, if somebody would like to see it, a copy of a patent issued to two men who worked for Bell Telephone Labs, patenting the 4545 system, and the patent is dated 1936. And Westrex later, I don't think they knew about it, they developed the 4545 system, went to patent it, the patent office came back and said, no, you can't. And I think Westrex at that time was still owned by Western Electric, and they could not patent it because of the fact that it had been issued to their company back in 1936. And if actual model was existed, I don't know. But they lay out on this patent just that whole point of 45-45. but it's an art. It's not a science. And there are still, there's about three or four studios in the States that are doing LP mastering, and probably one processing house. Anybody here not familiar with the art of processing and pressing records?
I'd like to know what some of the parameters were involved in the mastering, cutting those discs.
You started out, first of all, with, you had a tape, 10.5-inch reel, and you looked, first of all, to see what was the time. And a term that we used was TTBC, total time by the clock, from the start of modulation at the first cut to the end. And you looked at it, and it was 17 minutes. Okay. And you would set the LPI, lines per inch, on the lathe accordingly. And the first Scully lathes were fixed pitch. You would dial up a particular number, and we had charts that would do that. Later on, variable pitch came in, where we might start out first with 250 LPI, and the system then would read the signal in advance. We generally use Zampex 300s, and the advance head was off to the side, picking up the signal about one revolution before. So the and you generally played the material through once, and you watched it for the maximum level, and you could hear the Scully variable pitch system. The dial literally turned, and you might have to do a couple of test cuts, or you'd play the loud portion. But the
pitch of what? Not tonal pitch.
No, the pitching in lines per inch from the center of one groove, which was easiest to measure, to the center of the next, 200 LPI, which was pretty coarse. And if you were up to 300 LPI, you had very, very quiet passages, and your grooves got pretty close to one another. So the beginning diameter and the ending diameter were pretty well set, and then the concentric lockout groove was also set. This was done by the RIAA, and our lathes were adjusted so that we would come in cutting generally on 14-inch lacquers or 13 1/4, and you'd drop the head. You wouldn't drop it, but let it down earlier, and then it would go into the starting diameter. And depending upon the room, it would automatically start, or you'd watch it and punch the play button. And then spreads would be the same thing. You'd watch the leader tape coming up, and so you'd punch the spread button, and it would do that slight advance to give you the space to drop the stylus in the space on playback. And then when you got to the end, you punch the lead out button, and the head ran into the concentric diameter, made one turn to make that concentric circle finished, lift the head, and you were done. And then we would mark the style, the lacquer, sometimes on the inside, depending upon the processing plant, or on the outside. And God help you if you got the wrong master on number on it, because there would be massive problems later on. And the record company would say, okay, the master number, which is totally independent of the record number, the release number, and they had particular things that they wanted done. And very occasionally you might put your initials on the inside to show that you had done it. But some houses didn't want anything in the inside other than the master number. And the... Shoot again.
Is a master a single-sided thing at the
yes.
beginning, or
yeah.
is it double?
It was basically a sheet of aluminum, which is about, a 16th of an inch?
No, it wasn't that thick, I don't think.
Yeah, but very flat and fairly soft aluminum, very handy for building things. And it was coated on both sides with a proprietary compound that was casually called lacquer. It was definitely flammable, because if the chip, which was the material brought up by the cutting stylus, if that got caught up underneath the head, and we had what are called heated styli, the stylus head some turns of nichrome wire, and that heated it, and that was found sometime back that enabled us to cut a very quiet groove. And if the chip got caught under because the suction tube was not working properly, whoosh, oh, shit, mutter. And so you'd stop and throw the lacquer away and spend a while cleaning the underside, which was, oh, good grief, miserable, no fun. But so that diameters I talked about, and the level on it, we generally would do seven, let's say, Bunny called it centimeters, but the normal recording zero level was 7 centimeters per second. And what? 7 centimeters per second? Where, no, there's the book.
Well, you're looking for that 7 centimeters of what? Of travel?
No. The groove velocity. If you're cutting monaural this way. This I bought this later from the internet. And if you said 12.549, I'd say, oh. And this was the standard. We had one of these in each room. And
why don't you tell people what that is? So
okay.
Who are far,
this is
away.
A frequency test record recorded with the RIAA curve, or what RCA like to call a new orthophonic curve. And in general, what was done, you reduced the low frequency, because if you recorded it at flat response, the movement of the stylus, going back to some good basic laws of physics, you would have a great problem. So they rolled off the bottom end at a specific rate, and then to overcome the noise of playback, you boosted the top end. And then in playback, in an RIAA preamp, you did the reverse. You booted the bottom end and rolled off the top, so you had a flat response. And before RCA came out with this, in the earlier days, there were various recording curves, nothing fixed. And everybody had a slightly different curve, what they call the turnover point. They used 1,000 as a reference, and they would have different amounts. And finally, RCA and RIAA got together. So this became the standard recording curve, and it made life easier. But this was a pressing. They used 10-inch for convenience, and if you look at it under any kind of a point source light, you can see it. And Jerry and I looked at these more often than not, and you can see how the levels change, because you look at any LP, and you can see the quiet passages and the loud passages because of the light reflecting off the disc.
So this disc is a reference so that you can look to see what a 50 hertz tone should look like on
yeah.
the record?
Yes, right.
So it's not a playback, it's a
visual. It's a playback, it's a record and playback. That's the record curve.
Yes.
And the reverse of that, it would be the playback curve.
But why do you need the record for that? If you have that, you can calibrate your record and playback curves in your device.
If you have what?
That curve. If you know that 40 hertz should be 20 dB down, and you know that 12K should be 18 dB up.
They have a chart in the back. Okay, because with the design of the cutter amplifier, you could adjust it, but how did you know that you had that for the record curve? You could say, well, I'll cut a test record. Okay. So you look at it. You can do it visually using what's called a Buchmann-Meyer light, discovered by a German, but then you play it back, and how do you know that the playback is the reciprocal of that? So the record goes on the playback turntable, and you set the playback turntable if the EQ is adjustable. So you say, okay, now I've got a flat response. Then you record your test disc at a lower level, and you play it back, and it comes out flat.
getting back to the idea of when you said the art of mastering.
Yes.
And when and how did EQ and compression or limiting come into the mastering phase from your perspective? And was Putnam's, like the LA2s or any of the limiters, was that relating to mastering?
EQ, I think, came into use over a period of time. It was not a case of suddenly we have EQ and before that we didn't. When I worked for Bill in Chicago, our mastering room, we had a limiter, not a compressor, but a limiter. And I think we had a cinema program equalizer, and I think that was it. I don't think we even had a high-pass, low-pass filter. Then later on in Los Angeles, Bunny Robine, who was one of the other people that he brought in, Bunny had worked out how to do hot records, and we had a limiter and a program equalizer and a high-pass, low-pass, and a cinema graphic, which was a graphic equalizer across the audio band, not third octave, not that many. And it was a matter of listening to it and saying, oh, that sounds pretty good, I'm going to leave it alone. Or, no, we're going to have some problem on bottom end. But I think it came into view over the years. Somebody came along and said, oh, you know, we put an EQ on that, it might be able to do things. And limiter, absolutely, because not all companies, record companies, or producers paid real attention to levels. So you'd look at it and you'd say, holy Toledo. You'd sit there with a level knob. No, that's very impractical. So it was a matter of the limiter came into view. And Bill's development of the 175, which was the first limiter, which was vacuum tube, that I think he said we just need a better limiter for studio use, for mastering, whatever. And that had one compression ratio of 12 to 1?
12 to 1, yeah.
Do you remember it? Yes. And then later on he did some more experimenting and came up with the variable compression, the 176, still a vacuum tube. And then he and Brad Plunkett developed the solid state equivalent, the 1176, which is still around. And the variable compression ratio was very good, because you didn't always want a limiter. You wanted to be able to, particularly on studio work, you wanted to do something softer. That's where it came by. Does that answer enough your questions about mastering?
Yes.
And once we finished with that lacquer, we had, good grief, that brings me back. We had a box full of quarter-inch bolts and nuts and cork washers, generally about so big in diameter. So we would ship lacquers to generally three plants, to the Los Angeles, to Midwest and East, and you'd pack them in this box. You'd start out with a quarter-inch bolt and stack them up and fasten them inside the boxes, corrugated cardboard boxes, so they were in that box but separated by air, because you didn't casually wipe a finger. That took care of it. And you didn't touch the lacquer afterwards. And that would be shipped to the processing plant. And then, should we talk about record processing? Anybody interested?
Actually, okay. While you're still back on the tapes of the mastering, you get the tapes in to come from, so the mixing engineers would make the master tape to send to you to lathe from.
Yeah.
So those were quite variable, depending on the studio that comes from?
Well, most of our work was in-house, because United itself, well, Universal in Chicago, most of our stuff was in-house, and at United, we had two studios working, and when Western was added, that was two more. So there was enough work in-house that we were dealing with our own source material.
And everyone was consistent up to a certain...
Yeah, pretty well. And on the tape, we would put, generally record a one KC or one kilohertz tone, so you'd play it back, and okay, that was a reference level that you knew was a guide. And hopefully in mixdown, the mixdown engineer or dub down, pick the phrase, he could adhere to it. But with in-house material, it was pretty straightforward. I worked for a while later on for a house that got stuff in from all over, and you really had to pay attention to it. You couldn't just say, well, it's going to be fine levels. No, you'd play it through and discover that we got to change the level on this track, up a couple and down a couple dB.
And this is all done in real time?
Yeah, all of that in real time, yes, right. And you couldn't say, well, I'll dial up on the computer to keep track of it. Computer? What was a computer? Didn't exist. And also, digital did not exist. I mean, digital? What was digital?
This.
Yes, right. I've got 10 digits. But the processing operation, that go to the pressing plant, they would inspect the lacquer, they would wash it with deionized water, and then they would spray it with a silver reagent that would make that surface electrically conductive. And it was on a molecular scale. So that disc, that lacquer, which was now electrically conductive, go in a processing bath, and they would plate, Jerry and I are still not sure, possibly chromium, nickel against it, and let it plate to the appropriate thickness, take it out of the bath, and carefully separate them. And the lacquer master was generally thrown away because you couldn't do that again too often. But you had a metal master, which they would examine very carefully. And at that point, of course, we had ridges instead of grooves. So they would look that, and if it was a full-scale release from Warner Brothers or Reprise or Dot Records, that would go into another plating bath. And from the metal master, they would do a metal mother, which could be played. And from that master, they could probably pull, depending upon how the conditions were, they could pull a number of mothers from it. And from the metal mother, they could pull that many more stampers, which was a third step. And the stamper was a very thin material that was, again, probably maybe 60, no, more like a 32nd of an inch in thickness.
They were very thin.
Pardon?
They were very thin.
Yeah. And then when an RCA came along with Dynagroove, which simply put a ridge on the outside and raised the label so that they wouldn't, the surfaces wouldn't scrape on a record changer, what they call that, coining, I think. They would trim the outside to the right diameter and punch a large hole in the center, and that would go into the record press with both sides. And the record press was so big, and it was nothing more than a huge...
It's hydraulic press, I guess.
Pardon?
It's like a hydraulic...
Yeah, hydraulic press. And it was heated with steam, and the biscuit, which was a chunk of vinyl, about fist size, and pre-warmed, the operator would put the label, which, if you remember, is molded into the record. It's not pasted on afterwards. It costs too much. But he would put the biscuit on there, the label on first, the biscuit, put the other one on, close the press, and the cycle time was about 90 seconds, I think, and about 30 seconds cooling time, and the press would open, and the operator would take it out and then trim the flashing from the outside. That was it. You now have a finished record, which was stacked up and let to cool.
So did you squish it flat?
Yes.
Yeah.
Something like
a waffle iron.
Oh, I remember seeing numbers, looking at them, somewhere about 3,000 PSI.
How did they maintain concentricity for the hole? Because every so often you have a hole that's offset.
Oh, When the earlier eccentric grooves were done, it was a problem for the processing house to be able to center it, because they had to punch the large hole in the center, and if they punched it off, you played it back and you were in trouble because you had beaucoup amounts of wow. But then when the concentric groove came along, which was also for the benefit of the record players, then the processing house under a microscope could say, okay, that's the center, We've got the stampers in the center. Then they would punch the large hole. And, of course, the farther off center, the more wow you got. They were pretty good. Sir?
I'm just scratching my head.
All right. But anyway, that was and still is the practical part of record pressing. So each record was individually pressed. There was no automatic duplicating, but it was each record was individually pressed. Mike, you look as though you have a question.
Well, I was thinking about something that it may not have been Bill Putnam centrist, but last night we were talking about some of the music you had been involved in. I have to mention that there had been this 15 record kind of transfer I was involved in, and I was so impressed with it. I mean, the sound was fantastic, and it was from like the late 50s, early 60s, or you know, right around that period. And I was absolutely blown away. And before knowing anything, I just wondered, who are these guys? And then I saw absolutely some of the most outstanding musicians in the world were on the project. It sounded fantastic. I mean, it's just like, who are these guys? It was so good. Well, last night I found out Jerry was the mix engineer on. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Okay, for some of it, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought, how about that?
And the mastering, I did.
What was the project?
Oh, well, it was a series of recordings that was made by
Herman Klebanoff.
A group I'd never heard of before. It's called Herman Klebanoff. It's the leader of the group. It's mm-hmm. the Klebanoff Strings.
Yeah.
It wasn't just strings. It involved a lot of percussion, brass, and so forth. But if you looked at just the list of players, they were the absolute best guys down in Hollywood. And how did they get all these guys in the same group? Because usually these guys were the principals. They were the lead guys. And they had all these fantastic players in this same, you know, orchestra, band, whatever, you know, this assemblage of musicians. And it was stellar. It was really good. And the recording was so believable. It was extraordinarily clean. The dynamics were fantastic. I mean, it was really something. And so I was really blown away. And it's just so amusing, too, because it was believable. You know, you think of, well, you see with the technology we have today and what we can do and da-da-da-da. It'd be interesting to see someone record as well. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying you've got to really know your stuff. You really do in order to do what that yeah. was. That was remarkable stuff.
Let me interject a little bit here.
Let me toss in before you start. In the people I worked with at Universal in Chicago, Atlantic in New York, basically one man, Tommy Dowd, who was an artist in his own right, and all the people at United and Western, I don't remember anybody on the technical side that said, well, I'm here to work today. Yeah, okay, that's it. Yeah, I got 8 hours before I go home. It wasn't that at all. It was people that were interested in what they were doing. And it was, hey, you cut thus and such a little bit hot. And it was a matter of great interest. Roy Dunan.
Yeah. Who's a neighbor of ours out in Baltimore?
I met Roy at Contemporary, and Roy was a very dedicated guy, and so was his boss, more or less, Les Koenig. But all the people I met through the years, it wasn't a case of, well, it's an 8-hour day job, 40 hours a week. It wasn't that at all. It was a matter of, hey, how could we do it better? Anyway.
So were you primarily a mastering engineer then throughout?
No. This was what made it all the more fun. That working for Bill, I was either mastering, I did some studio dates, nowhere near as much as Jerry did. I did a fair amount of mixdown, a lot of editing, and then a lot of special projects. Because Bill looked at Jerry and I as the technical, would you say?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
And he'd call us and say, hey, I got a project. And for him, it wasn't just a case of, well, let's start on it next week. It was a case of, it's 4 o'clock, you can start on it now. And more often than not, we'd be on some project, and so we would stay at a nearby motel, courtesy of United, because it was midnight plus, and no time to go home.
More than once.
More than once. Your turn. What?
Yeah, I just wanted to interject one thing about these. Bill used these same plugs a lot of places. All of the original early consoles had this type of plug on them for patching. Obviously, it used up a lot of territory, so it took a pretty good sized patch bay to do it the way we did it. Most of our consoles had patches in and out, so that you could insert stuff into the bay. In other words, or into the console. For instance, we'd have fader out into a patch, and it would normal down to a patch below, which was amplifier in, a line amp in, or bus in, whatever. And so that you could take two pieces of equipment with these cords, plug them in, and insert this thing somewhere in the chain. So it took a lot of jacks. And we also used these things on the inputs and outputs of all the tape machines. Now, you can imagine once we got up to 8-track what that was like. We had a snake that big around and it took two guys to carry it. But we finally decided that, hey, enough is enough. We don't want to do that anymore. It was great for monaural. Because as Bob pointed out, and even the early stereo stuff, as Bob pointed out, we did get, answer one of the questions that we had over here, we did get some stuff from other studios. And in fact, Bob, when he was working in Mexico, sent me a whole slew of Mexican stuff, and I learned to like Mexican music. But
the stuff we sent you, we tried to keep polarity correct.
Yeah, I know. But you weren't the only ones we did, and we did a lot of mastering from other studios as well, and sometimes right in the middle of an album there'd be a swap for whatever reason, and some of these record companies were doing stuff in all kinds of different studios, and they'd assemble them all into an album and so leader them up and they're ready to go. Well. You get along about halfway, and you find out all of a sudden the drums are out of phase, bass drum, and everything is going vertical on the stereo cuts, and that in fact, especially with the ones we had, the original cutter heads, the Fairchild, in particular, wrote on a what they call an advance ball, which was a polished half round piece of sapphire that wrote on the surface of the record to support part of the weight of the head. The head itself was suspended from a spring, a pretty stiff spring, because that head was heavy, and a little bit of it rested on the advance ball. And that was in order that we could adjust the depth of cut by raising or lowering the advance ball. Well, along comes a big vertical cut, and you could literally lift the needle right out of the record, and the groove ceased at that point, so... and when the needle hit that, it just went yoop, 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 across the record.
So
then
you'd start again?
What? Well, the problem with that was you didn't really know it until it was too late. I mean, you cut the whole thing, and of course we inspected them before we sent them out. As Bob said, a lot of times you'd have to spend the time to do a test cut. Especially if you weren't familiar with the material and it came from someplace else, you make a test cut first and even play it all the way through just to make sure it was okay, and before you cut an actual master. We just cut it on a dub blank, which is the same basically as a master blank, but not of as good a quality. It was necessary to do that because they, and we could just turn the thing over, and go about our business. It wasn't worth it time wise for us to take, and like you said before, you have to do it on the fly.
Mm-hmm. So the leader would come by,
and if I had a problem like that, I'd call one of the other guys to give me a hand.
Would it make a pop or anything?
No, well, that's what I'm saying. I'd call one of my buddies to give me a hand, and when we got to that to that band, he'd dial down the master pot, and I'd swap it, and he'd pull it back up again in the 4 seconds we had in the leader, you know. So that, it was teamwork. There's another thing that Bill came up with, which was really unusual, and it may actually have been used on that Klebanoff album, and that is what we call two-thirds speed mastering. We ran, and plus the tape itself might have been a 30-inch master. We did some stuff, 30-inch, some Sinatra stuff and some other things for reprise, special projects. We cut them at 30 inches per second to get better transient response and the whole thing. But what we would do is run the tape at a lower speed to get the high end down where, because I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the higher the frequency, the faster that stylus is moving. And because the material that we're cutting in is fairly soft, you reach a point where the stylus actually shoves the material out of the way instead of cutting it. And when that happens, it springs back again when it goes pie, you know, so because it's soft and it springs back into place again. So you lose a lot of high frequency on the thing because you don't get as much wobble level. The highs are still there, but they're diminished. And so what we did, Bill came up with the idea, well, let's run the thing. And this was in particular was in the stereo setup. We had a Neumann lathe, and the Neumann had a Lyric motor in the bottom of it that ran at different speeds. It ran at three speeds, 78, 33, and 45. And it had a half-speed switch. And it was direct drive off the motor shaft. The motor shaft actually turned at 33 and a third. The way we did this is we would run the turntable motor at 45 RPM and then switch it to half speed. And that took it way down. And then we did the same thing with the tape. We had a special capstan made for the tape machine, slipped over the top of the tape capstan, and little cap screw on the top to hold it in place. And that ran the 15, or in the case of a 15-inch tape, ran the 15-inch tape at 11 and a half, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, somewhere's in there. And that took the high end down and allowed us to cut that at a slower speed so that it didn't shove the stuff out of the way. And boy, when you played that stuff back, it was just brilliant. I mean, it was incredible. So it may have been done that way. And we, of course, had to change the equalization curve because when you brought it back up to speed, it would be off. It wouldn't be RIAA anymore. And so, and we had two of them to deal with because we had the NAB curve on the tape machine that was going to be off, and we had the RIAA curve that would be off. So we had to compensate for that with a special EQ switch that we used to put in there to take care of that. And so that brought it back. But that may well be what was used on that album you're talking about. Because we did a couple of them like that. And we also did some direct from 35 millimeter for Klebanoff strings.
Yeah, we did those too, which were wonderful.
Yeah, those were. I'm surprised you say that because 35 millimeter speed a tape or film.
Oh, are we talking about film?
Yeah.
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 At best,
it's not the greatest.
Well,
you know.
Yeah, and it's funny because in the album, you know, they're extolling the virtues of film, you know, 35 millimeter and so forth. And they were saying, look at the width of this and look at the speed.
Oh,
this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but the speed really wasn't any more than like 15 inches per second when you get right down to it. If you know, it's very close. The speed that film runs at, 35 millimeter film runs at a speed that's very close to 15 inches per second. And the heads on them are pretty, in those days anyway, they were pretty wide gaps on them. So you didn't, you know, it wasn't the greatest. But there was a big fad that went on. Bob Fine in New York started that whole thing. He had a film studio, and I guess he wanted the drum-up business, and he decided to con somebody into, hey, why don't we record it on 35mm? Well, yeah, that's going to make a big profit on that stuff. So, you know, and he did. They made a couple of things. They did some stuff for, three or four labels, at least, that I know of.
Yeah,
and
Mercury.
Yeah, Mercury, there was another one that was a super hi-fi at the time.
Command,
that's what it was, Command Records, yes.
You might mentioned also about the point with two-thirds mastering, we had to do lots of test cuts.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Because you weren't listening in real time.
No.
It was when you were a little up.
Yeah.
You couldn't
tell for sure what was happening until you played back a test cut, you know. But that kind of thing is typical of what Bill did. I mean, he was always thinking about stuff like that, you know. And even though he himself didn't maybe necessarily get involved in the nuts and bolts of it, he would lay the idea on Bob or myself, and we went about trying to get it to work, you know. So that's how that came about, and it was his idea, and he didn't do much mastering himself. Not that he couldn't; he certainly knew how and did, you know, in the earlier days. But once he got into managing the studio and what have you, and after the studios were built, he didn't have as much hands-on as he did before. He did do. A lot of the original recordings for certain artists, because they were friends, you know, from Chicago and whatever. He knew all the jazz musicians. They all came out of, out of the blues studios and stuff in Chicago, and a lot of them came out to the West Coast, and so he knew a lot of them. He knew Frank Sinatra, and he knew some of these other people, and when Frank started Reprise Records. Bill did the first couple of albums that went through there. But then, you know, he sat back and he let somebody else do it after that. He kind of mentored all of the guys at the studios on mic setups and that kind of thing, because not everybody understood the patterns on all the microphones we had. It was kind of a task to keep track of them all, you know. When we had as many studios as we had, and they all had to be compatible with each other so that we could exchange equipment back and forth. All of our cords had to be meticulously in phase and everything else, because otherwise, you know, you could plug in one mic here and plug in here and from another studio, and it was out of phase, you know. You can't have that. So it took a lot of upkeep, as it were. And we had some really terrific people working maintenance for us. We really did. They were really stellar guys. And I don't know, you probably have all heard of Frank DiMedio. He was one of our original studio maintenance engineers. And there was a couple of other guys that went through there, you know, and then ended up in other places. But it was a good team. And as Bob pointed out, everybody that was there treated it like a team. You know, it's a team effort. Practically every one of our mixers could also walk into a room and make a master. They all knew the mechanics of it and how to do it. And of course, the lathes were automated pretty much. So it wasn't too much about how you drop the head at a certain point or whatever. The lathe took care of that for you. As far as the grooves, having room for the grooves on the record, the automated systems monitored, especially the stereo, monitored the phase on the record, on the tape. And if you had a particular piece of music where there was a lot of vertical movement, it automatically would open the lateral cut as well to clear the extra depth that was happening. Because when it went deeper, of course, the groove got wider. And when we cut most of the records we cut, I think especially with the automatic stuff, we would start out around 300 lines per inch and with a 1 mil cut. And that left very little land between the grooves, but it was there. Just all it takes is a little bit, you know, to hold the needle because there's no modulation, you know. So under no modulation conditions, it was no problem. As soon as modulation came along, a half a groove or half a revolution ahead of the actual cut, groove would move out like this and make room for that stuff. And as soon as it was through, it would come back down again, you know. So, but again, the vertical had to do the same thing. And that was a problem with the Fairchild, which was normally riding on an advance fall, because you couldn't do that with the thing riding on an advance fall. You couldn't move the head up and down into the disc, you know, so to get the extra depth you needed. So we had to float the head, which meant a big heavy spring on that thing, and we floated the head above the and set the advance fall so that it could only go just so deep. And so it was used as a limiting point, rather than an actual adjustment of the depth. And the head assembly on the Neumann had a solenoid on it, which when you increase the current, it would pull the head up or down. And that was modulated by the tape. And the tape would let the head up or down according to what it needed to do. Needless to say, you hang something that heavy on a spring, you gotta walk on tippy toes all around the thing, because you don't want to bump it anywhere, you know. Or if you do, you're out of luck. You start over.
Let me toss in about thinking of response. We were talking about the recording curve. One of our maintenance engineers, who was a very interesting guy, Warren Gilman, Gil was his nickname. He came up with a technique, and he built up an equalizer, which was a playback equalizer.
Yeah.
And each morning he would come in to the mastering rooms, get it warmed up, and he would do a freak run, shorthand for frequency response run, and he'd do a freak run through this playback box and cut a lacquer. So the result was that you saw a flat light pattern, which I'll show you for anybody who wants to see, and he would leave it, and they would put a date on it with a grease pencil, and so you'd come into the room and you'd say, oh, yeah, it's in good shape. And that was something that he worked up, and it worked out very well, because you knew what the response was that day for the room.
Yeah, when you cut a flat recording without, in other words, if you make a frequency response cut, normally what we would do without the box would be to turn off the RIAA equalization. We'll switch it out and run it flat.
Got about 1 minute.
Okay. And in order to do that, we shut it off, make your cut, and you can hold it under a fluorescent light with the tube and parallel to the tube, and you can see a wide band of white light where the thing is. And as you cut each frequency makes a separate band. And you can see it go up, or you can see it go down, or whatever it is, and you can tell if it's flat or not.